Wow, Edwin. Oh man, you're hidden behind a pile of clothes. You couldn't production design your room better. Like literally, Edwin, I can see you less than I could the week before because your room is filling up with stuff.
Yeah, because look. I mean, look, man. Look.
What am I looking at? I'm looking.
Looking at life. Life. Real life. This is real.
Secret Movie Clubbers to Secret Movie Club Podcast 34. Today, to end our Halloween-a-thon, we are devoting the whole episode to just discussing the horror genre, a summation episode, if you will. Each of us have picked a few movies. I have no idea what movies my fellow Secret Movie Club team members have picked out, but we're going to talk about why those movies, for us, exemplify what's great in the horror genre, or horrible, wherever you guys want to take it. And we're going to just talk about the genre as a whole, because genre is fascinating to me. I hope it's fascinating to you. But today is our horror summation episode. And before we dive in, who is with us?
Hello, it's Daniel.
Happy Halloween. It's Connor.
Hello, this is Alan Rickman back from the dead.
You're really leaning into putting the voice in the back of your throat, Edwin, on that one.
It is what I do.
You sound like an alien who watched Die Hard once and like focused on one vocal characteristic, Rickman. But it's better than I could ever do. I could never do a Rickman.
It hurts though.
It sounds like if Alan Rickman played the Roach Beetle in Men in Black when he's in the dude's skin.
Wow, that's a pretty deep dive there, Edwin. And I'm Craig. I'm the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. So announcements this week, it is November. Tomorrow, everybody else who hasn't voted goes to the polls.
This is a weird in-between episode for that because we're recording this before Election Day, but it will be released several days after Election Day. So
yeah, that's a great. So I'm not going to, all humility here. Connor's absolutely right. By the time you listen to this, Secret Movie Clubbers, on Friday, many things may have transpired that would make what we're saying today seem a little quaint or not. So we say with all humility that by the time you hear this, hopefully you voted. We'll see what happens. This weekend, we are devoting all of November to movies that we just want to bring people together. So this weekend, we're choosing four of our favorite Mission Impossible movies. Friday night, we're doing Mission Impossible 1 and then 4, Ghost Protocol, directed by Brad Bird. Saturday night, we're doing 5 and 6, both written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie and linked. They sort of form a little mini arc. Rogue Nation and Fallout. Then on Sunday, we are doing back-to-back the two Sundays we had to move. So we're doing Coco at 5:30, and then we're doing Nightmare Before Christmas at 7, which ironically may be better placed now as it's now in between Halloween and Christmas. I know there's always a debate about whether it's a Halloween movie or Christmas movie, and people are emphatic about both. And that's our weekend. And then we're going to be showing Back to the Futures, Indiana Jones. We're going to be showing Marvel movies. We're going to be showing superhero movies, Ratatouille, Aladdin, and our podcast in November will reflect some of the things that we're showing. If you haven't yet, our very own Connor Lloyd Cruz was the writer and director of our Secret Movie Club Radio Hour episode 4, titled MD_HH_30.FLAC, all lowercase, aka Mr. Devil's 30th Annual House of Horrors. And you can get that on, you just type in Secret Movie Club Podcast, it'll pop up, or you can go to Podbean. But Connor did many of the voices, most of the episodes, and he did a killer job of it. And we created an anthology episode that comes in right at 40 minutes. It's an easy listen, 4 stories. Daniel Ott, our very own Daniel Ott, contributed an episode called Seafog. I wrote one called The Sleeping Mariner. We'd love for you to listen to it.
All 4 of us are in it.
Even Casey. You even got Casey to do something.
Yeah, I got Casey. Has an uncredited cameo.
Yeah, we got everybody but Casey in that credit log.
Well, he goes uncredited because none of us go credited as ourselves.
Oh, got it. And so check that out. And we have a lot coming up in November, some announcements and talking about 2021, and we want you to be a part of that conversation. So if you have any thoughts, ideas, criticisms, concerns, you can always write us at community@secretmovieclub.com, or if it's podcast specific or radio hour specific, you can write us at podcast@secretmovieclub.com, and we would love to hear from you. Let's just dive right into it, guys. Horror. We've spent a month, and from what I can tell from all of us, unless I am just totally remiss and a horrible listener, all of us seem to like the genre. And none of us on this podcast were ever like, well, I'm here because I got to do it, but this isn't my thing. Whereas you could kind of imagine people saying, well, Westerns aren't my thing, or dramas aren't my thing, or whatever. You know,
you can hear people saying horror isn't my thing.
Totally. And yet all of us seem to really love
it. The stuff I picked was stuff I had kind of recently seen. I thought that would be, because I honestly can't remember what spectrum we've talked about over the last few weeks. So there's a lot of stuff that's been covered. So I tried to pick something a little bit off the beaten path. The first thing I was going to talk about was Alex Garland's Annihilation from 2 years ago, 2018. It's kind of a, surrealist is not the right word, but it's this sort of horror sci-fi mashup that has a pretty stacked cast. It's Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Gina Rodriguez, Tessa Thompson, Oscar Isaac, Benedict Wong. And it's about a group of scientists, one of which is a biologist. They're sent into this zone that is like this sort of shielded zone that has completely warped this sort of beachside area on the East Coast, and they're not sure what happens in it, because everyone they send into it doesn't come out, or they come out changed in some way, like they have no consciousness of sort of who they are. It's the opposite of pandering in that it answers very little questions that it presents with clarity. It's all about sort of an experience. You're in the same experience as the scientist. And specifically, it features a scene that I'll describe without getting into spoiler territory, but there is a character disappears at one point, we assume is killed off screen, and the scientists are later attacked by this creature who has taken on characteristics of the killed character, mostly in the final scream she made when she was being killed. And it is this sort of warped bear that's sort of half skeleton and kind of has like overgrown flesh. And it is one of the most frightening sequences I recall from the last few years of horror.
I was about to say, one of the images that really, and that one you called out is a great one. One of the ones that really scared me is when the first team, the team of men, before the team of women goes in, they record one of the characters and you see his organs moving.
Yeah.
As if they're alive. And
Cuts himself
open. And I wasn't prepared for that, even though I knew the movie was going to be wild. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, I'm really taken with the soundtrack. And it's such a visceral, the sound is very important into the plot. I don't know, it's a very overwhelmingly visceral movie. I'd say it's definitely one to check out. Not your standard horror flick, but worth a visit. I've come back to it a few times. And we've talked about Alex Garland before with his, you know, he did 28 Days Later. He wrote 28 Days Later and Sunshine, and he's now directed this and Ex Machina. So I think he's doing some very good work. My other decision that I sort of mentioned last week was I revisited Jennifer's Body, which is a Karen Kusama movie from 2009 with Amanda Seyfried and Megan Fox as the leads, written by Diablo Cody, who had just come off of Juno and was, I think, riding hot on... It's sort of this almost... Maybe not even a fair way to put it, but it's almost this feminist take on horror and sort of the male gaze and the way that women are portrayed in horror and sort of the expectations that are presented in the standard horror script, and they kind of invert those. She did, okay, so coming out, this is like the next thing, which is it's a very strange sidestep from Juno, which is like this very cute, quirky, lovable, romantic comedy piece that gets really real. And the Jennifer's Body is like a still very funny, very like off the wall with its dialogue, sort of quirky dialogue, but very violent piece of subversive horror filmmaking that I feel like didn't get a lot of conversation when it came out. And I think it probably should have. And there's been a reevaluation the last.
I think when it came out, the reason it got kind of dismissed was because Diablo Cody had been reduced to Home Slice and saying words like that, and Megan Fox had been kind of reduced to that scene in the first Transformers where she's washing the car. Those two things combined, people kind of just dismissed it.
Karen Kusama, she did like Aeon Flux and Girl Flight.
She did The Invitation, right?
Yeah, Invitation, and she did Destroyer from 2018 with Nicole Kidman. She's got a really interesting filmography, but sort of what she brings to this I think is great. And they use Megan Fox really effectively, because they're sort of taking that idea that a general audience has about her with something like Transformers and using that against us, because she is the person, she is sort of the character that becomes corrupted by this evil and starts to kill off all these boys. It has some very effective scares, and it's weird to see, because it's got like a young Chris Pratt. It has J.K. Simmons in like this very strange, goofy teacher role, and Adam Brody, who's also come back with Ready or Not from last year, is sort of having a resurgence. It just seemed like a very ahead of its time little piece of horror comedy film making, and it holds up really well, and I highly recommend it if you haven't checked it out.
Who's the other girl in that, the other lead?
Amanda Seyfried.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The star of Mamma Mia and Mamma Mia Here We Go Again.
Exactly.
Two of my favorites. I mean, that
star of Twin Peaks The Return.
Is she in, okay, I haven't watched Twin Peaks The Return, but that's very exciting.
She's dynamite actually in Paul Schrader's First Reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great. I think she's making some great decisions the last few years too. I think Juno holds up really well too. I happened to rewatch that this year. The other one I want to mention is sort of a horror-esque. It's The Love Witch from 2016. seen Anna Biller's A Love Witch, which is cool because in our radio hours, we've worked with one of the actresses, Jennifer Ingram, who, her and the whole cast, it's this sort of like 60s, 70s homage. It's shot on film and has this very specific look that makes it look like a B-movie and also sort of like an exploitation movie. And it's sort of about this, it's this young witch who basically seduces men and then kills them. But it's this very off, I mean, offbeat isn't even fair. It's everything it's doing with its genre conventions and also sort of its modern take on it is interesting. Someone described it once as like a, it feels like an old pulpy paperback. And it's like this Technicolor melodrama. It like sort of winks at like all of the, I don't know, the old like perverse conventions of horror. But then it's sort of this playful thing too. And
well, it's interesting. Your three picks too are all female centered. There's an interesting thing about what you picked and how horror can deliver the genre goods, but almost by definition, horror is such a wonderful vehicle for subversion too, or for calling attention to things that people might be resistant to in other genres.
Well, I think we've talked about before, it's so hard to define because horror as like a, as the top genre definer isn't really fair. There's just so many levels and they all do such interesting things and sort of use what you know in horror, what sort of the classics have set up to use against you or to like fulfill sort of the services that we want from them. And I guess I've been really interested in the last few years with films that kind of take that and turn them on their head. Not to trick you, but to use sort of what you expect to get bigger scares or to tell sort of more interesting stories because we sort of know how it's supposed to work. And so it doesn't have to spend the time kind of getting us into the mindset. We know how the thing works. And so therefore they can kind of jump around from it. But it's a good one. It's not, I wouldn't even, it is categorized as horror. I would put it more as like a, it's another horror comedy type of thing, but it's probably the least horror of them all, but I think it's fascinating and it's so good. It's got another one of those, it's just kind of a comfortable, call it like a comfort food type of movie where at any time you can, when you feel a certain way, you pop that in and it just feels lovely to be in that world.
I guess the one that really gets me is Night of the Creeps. Practically one of my favorite Tom Atkins movies and all-time favorite zombie film of mine.
It's me, Tom Atkins. Connor invited me to his home to be on the podcast. I'm America's new dad now that we kicked Bill Cosby out.
For our listening audience, Connor has a Tom Atkins mask on a popsicle stick ready to hold in front of his face, which I think you'll see in our cover photo.
Given to me by Stephen Brownlee.
Yeah, one of our Secret Movie Club team members. But so, Edwin, I want you to keep going, but you really hit on something. So Night of the Creeps, tell us what it's about. And would you just also tell us why people love Tom Atkins? Because I sort of discovered this through you guys, that everyone's just into Tom Atkins.
Because one, the stash and a great one-liner he says in the movie, thrill me, and probably one of the most famous lines he said in the movie, I got some good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here. Like, what's the bad news? They're dead, badass.
I think what makes Tom Atkins is he walks like the perfect line between cool guy and dad. And yeah. he exists like perfectly on that, to the point that you can believe him as a dad, but you can also kind of believe he would hook up with that girl in Halloween 3. Especially because she's characterized as being kind of like all over the place.
And Night of the Creeps and Halloween 3, that's what I always hear when people talk about Atkins. He was also in Creepshow, and the bookend, the Creepshow bookends. Are there any other real defining Tom Atkins roles?
Oh, he was a maniac cop, and that's it. He's in the Ninth Congregation. He's in Escape from New York.
Oh, there you go.
The Fog, right?
So he was all over.
Yeah, he worked with Carpenter a few times.
He's also in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, as the father, right?
Yeah.
The father whose daughter throws herself off the building. So, but Edwin, why Night of the Creeps? As a horror, I haven't seen it. Is it a zombie movie?
It's a zombie slash kind of alien movie. So the movie starts off with an alien spaceship where this little dude is running away with some canister that contains slugs that go inside your mouth and basically makes you dead. You're just a walking corpse. And it starts off pretty good. It starts off in the 50s, you know, with, you know, teens making out as soon as the spaceship, the canister crashed into Earth. Next thing you know, there's a serial killer on the loose. Next thing you know, dudes see the crash and then they go after it. And then the girl gets chopped up into pieces because the serial killer's around there. And then, boom, go to the 80s. Get your normally 80s teen horror comedy. Great cast. Very funny. Great special effects makeup for the actor who was playing the zombies are really cool. And some gnarly kills, I might say so myself. It's a great movie. It's one of my all-time favorite zombie movies of all time. I love it. And hopefully, Craig... You listen to me, Craig?
I'm listening, Adam.
I want you 100%. I want you 10,000 right now. I want you to show this movie on 35.
mil, all right? You're going to shoulder some 35 mil, all right? That's what you're going to do, right? That's what you're going to do.
Edwin, don't throw down on this one. We would probably show this one inevitably anyways, I feel like, kind of.
Well, still, you need to see it.
Edwin, I hear your enthusiasm. I sense you're using the tools of persuasion that you have in your toolbox. I respect the passion.
Well, The Hitcher is one of Ruggerhauer's greatest performances he's ever done. The dude is freaking terrifying as hell. As the kind of, they do say his name in the movie, but he plays up with a dude that's just wandering around, I guess just killing people, and he ends up playing cat and mouse with C. Thompson Howell. And you can see him falling apart every step of the way he goes, because once he's trying to find help, he doesn't. He gets screwed over again by him. And there's one point in the movie where he tries to kill himself because he wants his nightmare to be over. It's just one of the most best movies ever made.
Is it a possession movie?
It's a slasher movie.
Okay, so the guy who tries to kill himself is C. Thomas Howell, not Rucker Howard.
Now, Rucker Howard is just messing with this dude's mind. Like, he just wants to torture him until he gets to him. It's probably one of the best movies I've ever seen in a long time. I saw this at my grandmother's house, and then I tracked it down. I found out on Amoeba because I loved it so damn much.
You know, The Hitcher was a movie that was on VHS when I was a kid, and it kind of, the VHS cover scared me. There's certain horror movies that I would see and be like, oh, maybe I'll get to it. But like Daniel was saying about Ghostbusters last week, The Hitcher always seemed dangerous to me. It seemed like it could be a really unsettling movie. It seems like
it is.
Yeah,
it really
all
is.
Rules are off in that film.
Apparently, Sam Elliott was supposed to get the role for The Hitcher. He did good in the audition room. He even scared one of the producers so badly he couldn't go to his car. He needed someone to walk with him to
it. So my pitch for today's episode was Halloween movies. So I'm going to talk about it like that's what the topic is, because it still allows me to talk about two of my favorite horror movies. I actually looked at like my top 35, which I'm still kind of solidifying, and more than half of them are horror. We've talked about quite a few of them. There's also quite a few more that I imagine at some point in the future we would talk about, or at least I'm holding out hope.
Oh yeah, totally. This is not going to be our last horror themed podcast.
So I wanted to talk about my two favorite Halloween meaning the holiday, not the franchise movies, even though one of them is a Halloween movie. You know, because you could listen to this last year. This is an evergreen show. That's why we talk about the election so much. These movies are Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and Trick or Treat, which to me is the ideal Halloween double feature. They are both horror movies. They are both Halloween-centric in ways that, like, very few other, even, like, Halloween-ish horror movies are. Because the original Halloween, which I love and which I do like more than Halloween 3 by a little bit, Halloween's more of a backdrop for what's going on and for, like, thematic things with, like, Michael being able to wear the mask so he can move around outside. But Halloween 3 is very explicitly about, like, Halloween tradition and the holiday. If people don't know, Halloween, I'm not sure exactly what the intent was. I think making the first Halloween, it was just the intention to make one movie. And then I think afterwards, John Carpenter got the idea to make it an anthology series where every movie...
I thought you were going to mention part two because the studio offered him money to do it, and so they did it.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened. I'm not sure what the timeline is exactly. At one point, the intention was that all the Halloween sequels were going to be like different individual stories. And then I think what essentially happened is the first Halloween came out and did really well, influenced a lot of other movies like Friday the 13th, did really well. And the studio was like, oh, we should make a sequel to the first Halloween. And so I think Halloween 3, if it wasn't for how good the first Halloween did, Halloween 3 would have been Halloween 2, kind of. And Halloween 3 was very poorly received because people were like, where's Michael? Michael's not in this one. Where's Mike? Because it has nothing to do with any of the other ones. It is the fifth timeline in the Halloween series, the only movie that occupies this timeline. It is a timeline separate from our own in which the first Halloween exists as a movie because they see commercials for it on TV. But the plot is kind of hard to explain because it's sort of a mystery. It reminds me a little bit. It's another movie that reminds me of The Wicker Man in certain ways, and that it's about these people who go into this sort of weird community to investigate something that's going on. The setup for it is Tom Atkins as kind of a deadbeat dad and doctor. And one night while he's on call, a guy walks in freaking out saying like they're going to kill us all. And he's holding this specific type of mask. And then like during that night, some guy in a suit comes in, breaks his face, like pulls his nose out of his face to kill him. The guy then walks into his car, sets himself on fire and blows himself up. And Tom Atkins is like, well, that's kind of weird. And so then he starts, along with the daughter of the guy who was killed, start looking into what's going on, specifically with the manufacturers of the mask. And they start finding out this sort of sinister conspiracy. It's really good. It's a lot of fun.
I will say the John Carpenter composed this with his buddy Alan Howarth. I will say this, that Halloween 3, the score, is one of John Carpenter's best scores ever. It's one of my favorites.
I agree. I was going to say, I think it's my favorite of his as well. It's like my go-to. I have people over a lot, you know, when we're not in the middle of a plague, to play like board games. They often end up being spooky because I like those things in general. And that's always my go-to like thing to put on in the background is the Halloween 3 score.
It's a great score.
So Trick or Treat is a more recent anthology film, kind of like Creepshow, obviously pretty inspired by Creepshow. It's these four stories that take place in this town that really loves Halloween. The four stories, unlike most anthology movies, they kind of overlap and interact in a lot of different ways, to the point that it's like kind of weird even saying there's only four stories. There's really like eight that kind of all intersect in different ways.
And there's an Uber story that's developed across the entire picture, which is kind of cool.
That's kind of what I mean, is that like once you get to the end, you realize, oh, these three individual stories that I thought were completely separate are actually the same story, just different aspects of them. In that way, you could almost argue that there's really only two stories the entire movie. It's like this principal who poisons candy and is burying kids in his backyard, and these girls looking for dates, and these kids who are trying to like recreate this like town legend, and this old crabby guy who's like, he's like Scrooge for Halloween, basically.
The great Brian Cox.
Yeah, Brian Cox. I especially love Dylan Baker as the murderous principal. He's a lot of fun. It's maybe the most Halloween movie ever made. It's just chock full of Halloween.
I wanted to bring up two things real quick, because I think the two you mentioned are really themed. One is that both of these movies were not well received or were kind of buried when they came out. And now, you know, we sold out Trick or Treat. And I'm sure if we had done Halloween 3, it would have sold out. Now these things are beloved. And the second thing is that it almost seems like Trick or Treat delivers on what Carpenter wanted the Halloween.
Yeah.
Even though it's one movie, it's a bunch of different Halloween stories. Why do you think these two movies have risen in estimation over time?
I think because one, they're both good, because there's a lot of movies out there that have a lot of Halloween in them that aren't necessarily good. But then I think it's the same thing with Hocus Pocus. It's just Hocus Pocus is a little more family friendly. But I think that the same way that people want to watch Christmas movies on Christmas, I think people want to watch Halloween movies. And I think even though horror movies in general are appropriate for Halloween, I do think that there's kind of a difference between Halloween 3 and Alien, or Halloween 3 and The Shining. Like, those are less Halloween movies and more just horror movies, and it's kind of a different thing. We had the debate about E.T. earlier this month, and it's not a horror movie at all, even though I hate to look at E.T. He scares me to death. But it is, I would say, a Halloween movie. I think it qualifies as that. I think you think about something like Ghostbusters or Beetlejuice, I think it's the same thing, where I wouldn't really call either of those like a horror movie first and foremost, but I think they're both appropriate for Halloween, because I think Halloween is less about truly being scared and more about like fun and being spooked.
Something that's fascinating to me about Halloween is Halloween has a lot in common with Carnival and the beginning of Lent. And I don't want to get into like a rabbit hole with that, but I've always been fascinated at how people love the release of pretending to be someone else, or to wear a mask, or to get into costume and go to a party. And there's something liberating where it's like, on this night, we all have permission to kind of be someone we're not, or to hide who we are. And then there's this sort of liberation from our existential like albatrosses that we're dealing across from our life. So it's almost in a way too, Halloween is a liberating holiday, I think, for people. And it's hard to fully unpack it.
In a similar liberating sense, I've talked about on previous episodes, the catharsis that horror has. And because Halloween is like October is the month where people kind of embrace horror more, I think there's also something cathartic about the month as well for a lot of people. Whereas you think about something like Christmas, which I like Christmas, don't get me wrong, but Christmas is so like driving home, be happy, I want you to be happy, that I think it stresses people out in a way that Halloween doesn't. There's also the family stuff.
It's a wonderful holiday, whoever you are, whatever your relationships are. Because I think it's a holiday you can have a blast with on your own. it's also a holiday you can have a blast with a bunch of other people. Whereas I think Christmas is so tied into get-togethers that it can also bring a lot of depression and sadness and what have you. But I think Halloween, we had a bunch of people just roll and see movies by themselves in their car. And they weren't like, they didn't come being like, oh, I'm here by myself. They were like, yeah, like, let's do this. They were so psyched coming in their Hondas and Mazdas and Subarus. And it made me happy.
I mean, that was me. That was me, like, right before I started working for Secret Movie Club, as I showed up to that Evil Dead screening dressed up as Shaggy. And, you know, I was just there to see a good movie.
I wanted to talk about horror from the very beginning. And one movie I'd really recommend to people, if you really want to take a chance.
Is it the one with the train that comes at the screen? Because that's pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. The Lumiere brothers. A little after that, Carl Theodore Dreyer, a movie he made called Vampyr in the early, like late 20s, early 30s.
For people who don't know Carl Theodore Dreyer, he was a Danish filmmaker. Probably his most famous movie is The Passion of Joan of Arc, actually one of my top 35.
I watch The Passion of Joan of Arc once a year and just weep. One time I drank tequila and made something horrible and wept and then vomited. But that's a story for another time. It was kind of a funny combination. I was like, this movie's so moving, why did I drink tequila and eat this egg scramble? But Carl Theodore Dreyer made this movie called Vampyr, which even though it is about vampires, it really just has crazy imagery and that you can't define. We couldn't sit here and give some Freudian analysis to it. There's like a guy with a scythe at a river. There's a moment where you see this just long shot of someone being buried. It's just a bunch of unsettling, weird stuff, shots of clocks. And I think that it's one of the earliest films that gets at uncanny imagery where you can't really define it. Like, we couldn't sit here and be like, this means this. It gets to something in our subconsciouses that's beyond definition. And that to me is something I love about horror. Another movie jumping about 20 years is a movie from the early 50s that I highly recommend to everybody. Connor, I think you'd love it if you haven't seen it. It's the Jacques Tourneur directed Night of the Demon. Have you seen that one?
No, but it's been on my list for a while.
Oh, dude, you would love it. So Jacques Tourneur directed Cat People in these Val Lewton movies in the 40s. He's one of my favorite stylish directors. And when he went solo, he made a great noir called Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum. And then he went to England and he made this movie called Night of the Demon. And it's basically this skeptic played by Dana Andrews is in London, but there's some kind of convention and these people start to die when they get this like scroll thing and they claim that they see this huge demon. And then Dana Andrews goes into this underworld of London of psychics and the occult and devil worshipers and demonology. And it's like the 1950s, and there's just this crazy scene with these two twins who are like psychics and they do that seance kind of thing. And that's a movie where it builds, of course, to a third act. And I'm trying to think what the movie would be like. It's almost kind of like a proto Ring, you know, where it's like, if you see this video, you die.
And so what ends up happening, of course, is that Dana Andrews somehow gets a hold of the scroll.
And you're like, oh, now he's going to see the demon and he's a skeptic and what's going to happen. And it's just like beautiful black and white and atmosphere London. Another movie I'm going to touch on, we're going to show it, is Federico Fellini. No one ever talks about this Fellini movie. I'm huge into Fellini. It's very likely in the next year or two, our year will be devoted to Fellini like we devoted a year to Kurosawa. I am a huge fan of Toby Dammit. It's part of this anthology series. Talk about anthologies called Spirits of the Dead, where these European directors adapted Edgar Allan Poe's story. But Fellini does the last episode, and it's Terrence Stamp as this cocaine-addled British celebrity at the end of the swinging 60s who gets hired to be in a Western in Rome. And he gets to the airport, and he sees this girl. And the girl has red hair and she kind of like throws a ball to him. And you're like, what is going on? No one else sees the girl. He then has this kind of cocaine and alcohol addled day where he's doing press conferences. And the only reason he's doing this movie is to get this car. And he's like, where's my car? You promised me this Ferrari or whatever. Finally, it's nighttime and he gets the car and he just ditches all his responsibilities and starts driving in the Roman countryside. And it becomes this 15-minute silent. He's driving and screaming and he finally gets to this bridge and there's the girl again and she beckons him again and he just goes like crazy and he drives across the bridge and then his head rolls and the girl holds his head and she's the devil. And it's based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story called Never Bet the Devil Your Head. And it was one of my favorite stories because it was the devil was just this girl and this little girl, this little innocent girl. And Terrence Stamp almost wants to die, and he knows it's the devil, and it's just, it's a great movie. And the last thing I'll talk about there's a great Japanese film
from the 90s, 1997, called Cure,
which I highly recommend. It's definitely a serial killer movie. You can file it under
Seven. You can file it under Zodiac.
You can file it under Silence of the Lambs for sure. Except it has this really weird premise where the serial killer never does any of his own killing. He just hypnotizes other people to kill. And when they kill according to their sort of repressed desires. So
kind of like Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday.
Which I haven't seen, but I totally take you on credit on faith there. But if anyone hasn't seen it, it's definitely a movie where you're like, what a crazy premise. Plus, it is unsettling from the first scene where a guy in a hotel just kills someone with a pipe. And you're like, what? And then this investigator has to investigate it. And kind of like a lot of great horror, you're like, what's going to happen to him? You know, like if he gets too deep into this, it's just one of those movies, again, that doesn't really over-explain to you. But by the end of it, you're horrified because it almost talks about horror as a contagion, as a disease that anyone could get, even a good person. And I have to talk about this last one. We watched Psycho for Halloween, and I've always loved Psycho. It's always been one of my favorite Hitchcock films. Every time I see it, I think it is more radical and revolutionary cinematically than anyone gives it credit for. Every time I watch that film, I'm like, you know, the first 30 minutes is Janet Leigh stealing this money, and it's like her guilt. And you're watching this guilt and you're like, well, I'm in this. Only someone like Hitchcock could you be like, well, I'm going to hang out for this. I don't know where this is going. Then she gets to a hotel at like minute 30. And you really like Norman Bates, who seems like this really put upon by his mom. And all your sympathy goes. Suddenly a woman comes in and kills her in a shower. And you don't even question it. You're like, I guess the mom just killed her. Like, that's kind of crazy that his mom killed her. But okay. Then your main character's out of the film and it goes to other main characters, including a detective. You're like, I'll hang my hat on this guy. He gets killed 5 minutes later. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm not hanging my hat on that dude. And then her lover and the sister go to the hotel, and then they go into the house at the end, which to me is like going into hell or something. I can't explain it. And then you get that great monologue at the end where Norman is there in the voice of his mother. And then Hitchcock does this thing that tracks into Norman's face. And for a moment, there's a skull. And you're like, what is, like, literally the birth of the modern horror film is happening 18 years before it really happens.
Psycho is incredible. There's a couple of Hitchcock movies that I have on my favorite films as well, and that's one of them. The monologue before that last monologue is kind of a bummer, but everything else in that movie is great, and all the weird little directions it goes. I've seen Psycho 2 and 3. I know you've seen them, Edwin. Psycho 2 is really solid. I think it's like a genuinely good, thoughtful follow-up. The third one is like was Anthony Perkins' like directorial debut, and so he's obviously kind of distracted, so his performance isn't whatever, and it's just kind of a sleazy like slasher movie to a certain degree. But there's one shot where there's this build-up towards the beginning. When I had it from like the library a couple years ago, and I just watched this shot again and again because it's this sequence where a girl early on is like in the shower, and it's building in a way where you think Norman's gonna, you know, kill her again. And then we see this there's this shot, and it looks like it's a shot of like the bathroom door, like the light underneath it where everything is dark. We kind of pull back and we realize it's actually light being reflected on the knife he's holding. It like hurts my head when I watch it because I'm like, it looks so good. It is one of the best shots in any movie I've ever seen, and it's in Psycho 3, but they're worth checking out.
And I know, so Connor was referencing prior to in the first Psycho, there's a famous or infamous scene at the end where a psychologist comes out and basically explains Norman Bates's psychosis and the fact that he has a split personality, and half the personality is his mom, half the personality is him. And it's sort of this explanation about what we've seen. I find the movie much more inscrutable and weird and unsettling. I think a lot of slasher movies are like, okay, someone's killing someone. Like, we also watched Friday the 13th this last weekend, and like, I'm not confused. Jason Voorhees is killing kids or having sex and got it. But in Psycho, you know, you get this woman who steals money and she feels guilty, and she ends up at a place where she's in real danger. And then she changes her mind and wants to do the right thing and return the money, and she gets killed. And it, from a moral and ethical point of view, in normal movies, that's not what would happen. But that's not the universe we're in. So Hitchcock pulls this rug out and says, no, no one's safe. Doesn't matter what decisions you make. She ended up in the wrong place. But then the movie does something even more inscrutable, which is that Norman doesn't get away with it. Her sister shows up and her lover shows up. I can't really explain it. The movie is operating on an emotional subconscious level of guilt that it's really more than what you think it's about. And I just think along with its radical narrative, there's something about a radical sense of guilt in the world we live in, and whether the world is a moral world or an amoral world, or if it's a moral or an amoral world in the way we understand it. And when horror does that to me, that's when I love it. I'm like, now I'm in a mystery that I don't know. And I love being in the mystery. That's why I love David Lynch, too. So, guys, to you, what are the things you love about horror or hate about horror?
I've kind of talked about it in previous weeks. I mean, again, half of my favorite movies are horror. I've written handful of scripts, they're all horror in some way. It's kind of where my brain goes. Like I said, there's a catharsis to it. I think with these kinds of things, there's also a really interesting way that you can combine real world issues with fictional issues. Me and Mitchell of Secret Movie Club finished playing The Walking Dead Telltale this weekend on my stream for Halloween. And that game, at least, uses zombies as kind of a metaphor for life, just everything. You can do something broad like that. There's like readings of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that it's like a vegetarian, like it's an animal rights movie, which is, I think, kind of interesting. There's just so much you can pack into horror because you're dealing with things indirectly, as opposed to, I think you can apply the same thing with sci-fi and certain other genres. I think horror gets to me more because I'm just a spooky boy or something. I don't know. I'm just always been interested in it, fascinated by it, you know. They're fun. I mean, don't usually they kind of do the best for us?
No, totally. Yes. Connor, to answer your question, what's funny is that even when you program blockbuster hits of other genres, I could program an action blockbuster, and maybe people will come, maybe they won't. Just depends on their mood. We can program Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter, and it was sold out.
Well, that's like the best one, so people are going to come to that one. If you programmed Friday the 13th, part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, I don't know if we would sell that one out.
That's true.
But, yeah, I think there's something primal about it in a way that maybe other genres, there's a little more distance. You know, sci-fi, there's a little more distance from it in the sense that it's this thing kind of above us, where horror is almost like below us in a weird way. It's like our gut, you know?
I wonder if it's lizard brainy too, because you have to imagine that we lived millions of years in fear, you know, before the 2001 moment where we grabbed the bone and started killing things ourselves. Like for the millions of years that we were prey and hiding in trees and in that evolutionary process, probably existences were almost completely defined by fear. So I just wonder if the horror genre weirdly is the most, like, it goes to the very center of human psychology.
It's in our bones. That's why skeletons are so spooky.
Edwin, why do you love horror?
I don't know, just a genre, I guess. Seeing teenagers making out and getting killed because they kind of deserve it because they're kind of stupid. Actually, I said this to you for the Friday the 13th screening that if you think about it, Jason is the good guy and the teenagers are the bad guy because they're making out in his woods and he's got to clean them out.
Edwin, I love that read on it, though. Like, that's, you guys, Connor was already talking about it, but I love when somebody comes with an alternate read. And when you told me that Jason was the good guy and the teenagers were like the bad guys, I laughed. I thought that was a brilliant read on it because clearly Jason, he's still with us. Like, that dude never, I guess, he died and then he became a zombie. And
no, he doesn't die. He can't die. The dude just can't die. That's the point. He keeps coming back and back and back. Even if you blow him up.
That was the second version of Jason before he became a death elemental.
Oh, yeah. When he becomes like a whole skull zombie thing after part 6.
Whoa, spoilers.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And then he went hundreds of years in the future into space, too.
Yeah, he did.
I think horror forces the audience to confront things that make them uncomfortable. And I think from a filmmaking perspective, it's so interesting because you can put all these views you have, whether political or sexual or whatever's going on in your brain, and have them be these overt things that people will overlook in a way that doesn't feel preachy, they can be overlooked as entertaining. I think that's interesting because I think it also appeals to an audience who would normally be turned away by something they feel is trying to make them learn a lesson. And horror can hide that. I mean, we're in like this surge of incredible like horror filmmaking that's very focused into race, whether that's, you know, Get Out and Us. There's a new Netflix movie called His House that's very, very, very good. The HBO show Lovecraft Country that sort of warps the idea of H.P. Lovecraft, who is sort of infamously racist, and sort of how that his stories would directly affect or be kind of recontextualized in a Black experience. And so you can kind of hide stuff, and I think you reach... Horror appeals to all age groups, I think, but there's something, at least for me, I don't know if it was the same for you guys, but when you kind of discover there's like a special part of like your teenage years when you get into it, and it's a group thing. And I think having horror films like Get Out that appeal to that are putting conversations in without even trying, I mean, they're trying to, but without even like having to hammer it home. I think it presents conversations to young people that help them sort of build out who they are in that confrontation. Horror is kind of unique in that. It just can do so much. You can use any type of genre with it. That's why you get something like, to me, like Shaun of the Dead, one of my favorite things, is just as funny as it is scary, and it's because it knows how to play that against you. And I think every genre has its things, and I'm sure this could be true about it, but I think horror is very unique in that, in its appeal and just sort of what you can do with it to tell your story, and also what it says about you. The things that scare you or that you learn about yourself watching horror, I think are fascinating.
And have any of you had that experience where you've gone to see a horror movie or whatever with someone, a friend, and you notice that they or you react to something and the other person isn't affected by it? I once went to go see a movie, and my buddy, there was a needle. I can't remember. Someone was getting an injection, and I'd never heard him do this, but he was like, no. And he closed his eyes. And, you know, I was just watching it. And I know that there's stuff for me that I would do that on, but it's also interesting to see how we all have different phobias. You know, I think a phobia that really gets to me, I can watch it in a movie, but I do think it's a true phobia. I do have a phobia about being trapped in an enclosed space. I think about like, what if I was buried, you know, in a tunnel, or what if I was, you know, kind of like The Vanishing, you know, those things get at things where I'm like, that's uncomfortable for me. Very uncomfortable. So I think horror can get at those things, but then you can hit it off. You can be like, but I'm in my room, or I'm with my friends. I wanted to throw this in. Connor and I have talked about this. I'm a huge David Lynch fan. One of my favorite films of all time, also in my top 35, is Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. That's actually my favorite David Lynch film. We're almost certainly going to be doing something on Twin Peaks in the future. As a body of work, David Lynch's Twin Peaks is like Stephen King's The Gunslinger, J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. I mean, it literally is kind of a summation of everything that you love about that artist. And Fire Walk With Me is horrific. And I know people talk about this, but at its heart, it's a horrifying story about incest and abuse and rape, and the fact that somebody can commit those things and be both good and bad, that they can both love the person and be aware of their monstrosity. And I think that David Lynch gets at things that are almost too horrifying to deal with. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
There's with like Twin Peaks, with all of it, with Fire Walk With Me, with The Turn, there's something very like a almost religiously occult understanding of good and evil in terms of like the realities of it. Also Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the scenes with the painting freaks me out. That kind of stuff. Like, empty space is so creepy.
Well, and the way, like, that's such a great scene because it's so weird. Like, it's the old woman and the boy give her the painting. She puts the painting on her wall. She looks at the painting, and then she's in the painting. And somehow that makes total sense, but it's never explained.
It's just totally quiet as well, which I think Lynch does a lot, is playing horror very soft.
Well, and the thing you just said, Connor, and I've said this in blogs I've written about, and I'm superstitious about it, so I feel you can only say it with humility. I need to say it with humility, not cockiness. But I think that Lynch may get at a truth that, and again, this is me, I'm not putting it on anyone, but if there is a transcendent level to the universe, which I believe there is, it's not as clean as human beings want to make it out to be. Heaven and hell are not separate places. The transcendent level may be another level of existence where the conflict continues. And to me, that's such a revolutionary thing to say. And horror allows him to say that in a way that's not going to get atheists or the religious right jumping down his neck. No one talks about it. But you watch Twin Peaks and he's essentially saying the conflict continues into the transcendental plane. I think that's some heavy to deal with. So moving on to pop culture final thoughts.
Hey, so I Ghostbusters game was free on Epic Game Store. Played some of that, which is funny because last week also played a little game called Phasmophobia. You should pick that up, Daniel. We should play that because it's a lot of fun. It's in early access right now. But it's this like ghost hunting game and it's very physics based. So you're these like little first person, you know, and you're walking through this like fully rendered house and you're trying to find where the ghost is and trying to get like evidence, like the ghost talking to you and ghost orbs on video cameras and stuff. And it's really fun. But I want to talk maybe for more than a couple of seconds on the Halloween double feature I did with my friends last week. By myself, I did my Halloween 3-year trick or treat, which I always do. But with my friends, we did Suspiria, the remake, and Cats, which are both two terrifying films about dancing. They actually do have more in common than you would think in certain ways, and not just in the like, oh, Cats is so spooky. There is a dance sequence in Cats, like an explicitly non-vocal dance sequence, where there's this design on the floor that's strikingly similar to the design on the floor during a major dance sequence in Suspiria. If people haven't seen the Suspiria remake, it's much more about dancing than the old one is, which is kind of not about dancing at all. In the new Suspiria, they use the dancing as like witchcraft in certain ways, and I would highly recommend it if people haven't seen it. It's probably like one of the most ideal remakes like ever made, because it's literally like, what if we took everything that's not good about the first one, not everything that's bad about the first one, but these things that the first one doesn't have, and made the movie about that? What if we made like a thoughtful, slow, drama-based reflection on the horrors of World War II and East Berlin and West Berlin? And that's what it is, and it's great. And then Cats is a train wreck that I have maybe said this in the past, but when you see that movie for the first time, if you're unfamiliar with the musical, you're not just being confronted with the bad adaptation. You're being confronted with what Cats is, which is basically 2 hours of people introducing themselves with names like Rumpelteazer. And it's challenging and shocking. And there is some like satanic occult imagery in the Suspiria remake, but there's nothing quite as depraved as Ian McKellen licking milk out of a bowl, or Judi Dench raising her leg over her head. Yeah, it was a fun night. But yeah, and you can see me play those games that I mentioned earlier at twitch.tv/ConnorCruz.
I didn't do shit. I just been watching movies. I saw two psychiatric movies on the Criterion Channel, Old Boyfriends and Knife Congregation, and right now I'm currently watching Ordinary People.
Like currently while we're recording this podcast?
After we started. I saw them like 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I made a short film already starring Craig doing his ordinary routine, and then it turned into something completely different. I called it Looking for God. So look out for a sequel, because I'm look for him again with non-make sense things, sort of Lynch vibe. I used Radiohead for the music because it sounded nice and psychedelic and weird, and that's it.
I did not know you were gonna. So Edwin stayed at our house for a few weeks ago, and he was like, can I film you making your breakfast? I was like, yeah, sure. And now, because I want to support filmmaking, he was like, can I film you working at your desk? I was like, yeah, sure. And then I need to see this movie because I don't know what the footage is that comes after it. So, but I did give you permission. I mean, I did. So there you go. I just have to see how it works.
I didn't know what the hell I was going to use it for, but I guess I know what I needed to do. And your thing will change the whole vibe of the next footage after I go into the room. And it turned into something completely different, something weird, something strange, something unknown to this world.
Edwin, why don't you give your tag? What's your Instagram?
_crazy_movielover1985.
There you go. Check it out. Looking for God and Edwin Gomez joined.
I spent the last week, I weirdly got into studying the cryptography of boot volume drives for computer operating systems. I don't know how I ended up there really late at night one night. Very interesting stuff. And then I watched Josie and the Pussycats again, which I find myself returning to time and time again. Masterpiece. Highly recommend it. I also watched a movie that Edwin spoke highly of called Tetsuo the Iron Man, which is this experimental, I think it's Japanese horror film about this. I think they describe him as a metal fetish. fetishist who like starts to put metal parts in his body to make himself into this Iron Man, but he's like, there's a hit and run that kills a man, the metal man, and then he curses these people who have killed him with this obsession with metal, and they start to transform their bodies, and it's like this black and white, it kind of looks like the type of movie that you would receive that would curse you. It's just a very jarring but very effective piece of horror that I've thought about a lot, just because some of the images are shocking. And it's like, I think it's an hour and 5 minutes long, so it's nothing. I don't remember. I don't think I've done anything else.
Well, you've done tons. You're always helping everybody. Yeah, that's another movie, like The Hitcher. I saw a trailer for Tetsuo, and I've never been able to bring myself to see it. It looks like it's really intense.
Yeah, it's f***ed up. It's like got some very stuff in it.
But it's on my list. It's like Salo, 120 Days of Sodom. I've never been able to bring myself to see that movie.
What's wrong with Salo, man? It's just people eating shit.
Now, listen, I'm all for transgressive movies as long as everybody was consensual and they were adult, and it serves. Look, I've never seen Salo. I've never seen Salo. I've never seen Iron Man. I have seen Pink Flamingos. I don't know if that counts.
You ever seen Jackass 3D?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I genuinely love those.
He drinks horse semen.
I think I saw all three Jackasses, and I rarely gag, but the scene where they're drinking sweat and then the camera operator gags, I was in the theater and I started to dry heave a little bit, and then I had to just like center myself, and I was like, wow.
Beautiful. We should do a Jackass. You know, those exist on film. The first few do.
Exactly.
We've got it. We can get it.
We have to find a high and low culture thing. Like, we should do it with Lord of the Rings and just alternate like two trilogies.
Do it like with like Rules of the Game.
Or do Lord of the Rings extended, and in intermission you show Jackass 1.
Oh, boom. Next intermission, Jackass 2.
Yeah.
Next intermission, Jackass 3.
That's how you have to see it. You want to see Fellowship, you're also going to see this. You want to see Two Towers, you have to also have to see this.
It's one ticket.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just say it. It's November 2nd. It's today and tomorrow. By the time you guys listen to this on Friday, who knows what the next 5 days have in store for us. So in a weird way, this isn't really a go out to vote, other than I'll throw that psychic energy out there. I totally believe in it. This is it, guys. 2 days. I hope folks are voting today and tomorrow. At a certain point, you got
to give it up to God, give it up to the universe.
I do. But I believe in free will, by the way, as well. This is a conversation for another time. But I believe in free will and agency. I am not a determinist. So I do hope everyone exercises the right to vote and their free will. Edwin is going to go to the polls tomorrow. We're going to figure that out. He's going to vote.
Can we please stream that?
Maybe we'll vote it, or we'll record it. You know, friends, family, Americans. I just hope all of us vote. And if we all vote, then I think we're going to be all right. So let's see how that turns out on Friday. I wish you all the best, and I hope you do get out there and vote.
And that's it.
This weekend, we got some Mission Impossibles. We got Coco and Nightmare Before Christmas. Oh, we got a new Secret Movie Club Radio Hour, written, directed by Connor Lloyd Cruz. Again, MD_HH_30.FLAC.
I was trying to really goof up our SEO.
So to listen to it, a.k.a. Mr. Devil's 30th Annual House of Horrors. And you can always write us at community@secretmovieclub.com. And podcast@secretmovieclub.com. All right, guys, thank you for a month of talking about horror. Connor, I think next week we're talking about Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So our next podcast will be about the series no one thought would become one of the defining series, like quality series of the last 30 years, sort of defying everybody's expectations. So stay tuned for that. And that's it, guys. Have a great week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Tom Atkins.
Bye. See you guys later.
Very thankful for you.
Yeah, Carson, thank you for this. God, get out, you bitch. Got it. I got it.
We're pulling the battery out of the fire alarm.
Mm-hmm. Wait, is it still beeping?
Did you just say you didn't do this during the entire, like, 2 weeks you could have done this?
I've been doing stuff, man. I've been busy, all right? I've been doing things, okay, what? Connor? That's top secret government stuff, okay, Connor? You wouldn't understand it, okay, Connor? Thank you so much.
Do you understand it, Edwin?
Yeah, I do understand. It's called America, Craig. Oh my God, it's still beeping.